It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The National Weather Service says an estimated EF2 tornado struck northeastern Wisconsin yesterday, destroying homes and businesses, twisting vehicles on major roadways, and knocking out power to tens of thousands of people.
The tornado produced wind gusts between 111 and 135 miles per hour. Emergency crews are out assessing the damage in the Menasha and Appleton areas. Menasha's mayor declared a local state of disaster yesterday due to the widespread damage in the city.
Douglas Johnson of Menasha was visiting his mother in Appleton when the storm hit. He returned home to find his neighborhood torn apart.
The neighbors, they lost everything here. You can see it's just one big pile. That was a house.
Joe Schultz is a reporter covering northeastern Wisconsin for WPR, joins us now. Joe, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You spent most of yesterday traveling around the areas affected, talking with people. Where did you go and what did you see?
I went into Menasha. It was really kind of hard to get in just because there were, you know, the power lines were down kind of across the region, in the Fox Cities. There were a ton of down power lines in Menasha. And so there were no traffic lights. Specifically kind of the area in Menasha by Plank Road and the Manderfield Bakery, that neighborhood there was really hard hit. Mm. There were flipped cars, homes. Douglas Johnson, the guy we just heard from, his house was at like a 45 degree angle. It looked like a war zone in that neighborhood.
You spoke with Chris Silver of Menasha, whose house was left standing, but saw their neighbor's home destroyed. Let's take a listen.
I feel absolutely terrible for my neighbors. They're picking through their stuff, their whole lives, everything, their kids' clothes. It's gone.
Can you talk more about what these neighborhoods look like?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these houses... the Fox Cities is a pretty suburban area, so it's kind of, just like any residential neighborhood that you can think of normally. But houses missing windows, the roof ripped off, in one photo, a house is pushed into another. In some cases, there was a house and now there's just a pile of rubble. Some houses, Douglas Johnson's, are at 45 degree angles. Thankfully everybody that I spoke to yesterday, their immediate, family, their people, their pets, were okay. We don't, so that's kind of a bright spot. Everybody that I talked to, the people that they care about were okay. One guy, his entire garage collapsed, but the windows were shattered on his house and, the roof was off and, I don't know if it was off, but there was water in his house. There was pretty bad damage. And he was, he and his wife were going to stay in Oshkosh. They were going to go back into the house to collect some photos and some things that meant a lot to them. And then they were going to go spend the night in Oshkosh. Mm. And, people are just kind of picking up the pieces.
Yeah.
It's
very beginning of it. Any latest that you have reports for on injuries at this point?
Not yet. There is, local officials are going to do a press conference a little bit later this afternoon, or this morning, and we're hoping to get some additional information today.
Joe, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Joe Schultz is WPR reporter covering northeastern Wisconsin. Now we check in with how local officials are responding to the destruction. Tom Nelson is Outagamie County Executive. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Good to be on, despite the circumstances.
Yeah, Gordon Hintz is here as well, Winnebago County Executive. Gordon, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Gordon, starting with you, how are conditions in Winnebago County, where a part of Menasha is?
In the footage, it's pretty devastating. We just haven't seen anything like this in my lifetime. And the Menasha that I, drive through regularly, that I've worked in, it's been completely transformed. And it's going to take some time, for us to get through this. But so far, We have no known fatalities, but it's pretty devastating, the size and scale of the storm that hit.
Tom, turning over to you, what is the overall picture for Outagamie County at this point?
Well, first of all, I'd like to reinforce what Gordon said. In my 15 years as county executive, we certainly have worked through a number of disasters, particularly Shiocton just a few months ago with the flood. And if I were to compare what I have seen in Menasha, Fox Crossing, and throughout Winnebago, and I was using Shiocton as a point of comparison, comparing the level of damage and devastation that they are obviously dealing with, suffering, is about 10 times that of Shiocton. I cannot underscore, the last time I saw, just the devastation that Menasha and Fox Crossing are dealing with was really 20 years ago when I did a volunteer trip down to New Orleans to help with the cleanup from Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
It's that bad. Outagamie County, we got, I guess you could say, we kind of got clipped a little bit, southwest corner of Appleton. We saw some, houses that were destroyed, roofs that were blown out. Miller Electric was one of the buildings that was hit pretty hard. So we're certainly being able to take care of that, working closely with Appleton. But more importantly, we want to make sure that we are available to Winnebago County. There were a lot of people from Winnebago County that came up to Shiocton, New London, helped out. And I can't tell you how many people called from Shiocton yesterday asking me, how can we help? How can we go into Winnebago County and help? So we are here for the long haul, and we'll do all we can to help our neighbors.
Gordon, did this storm catch people by surprise, or how effective were early warning systems?
You sort of always get these questions. The National Weather Service did highlight that we could expect there to be severe thunderstorms and other conditions. I know my phone was buzzing with those text alerts that you get. We did have siren warnings the minute that a tornado was actually, spotted. But for this time of year, I don't think it's exactly tornado season. And again, I felt like there was a tornado in my childhood I remember getting in the basement floor in Oshkosh. Mm-hmm. But to have something, like this hit with the power that it did, it went from sort of, dark clouds to just, immediately right on top of Menasha in a pretty central thoroughfare. And just plowed its way, sort of to, from the Menasha High School Stadium to the lake and left very little behind.
Yeah, and that stadium just torn to pieces, and football was supposed to start training on August 4th. At 12:25 yesterday, National Weather Service said the twister was moving over Lake Winnebago. I wonder what it was like for residents around the lake.
Yeah, I'm not, I can't speak to that. The forecast was, we could have severe hail, 3-inch mm-hmm. hail, stay indoors, be monitoring things, but it did seem to escalate. And then we had about a 15-minute delay, between what landed and hit in Menasha that I was hearing from our emergency management director, to when the sirens went off in Oshkosh, that we could potentially have, a tornado here, or maybe the one that was visible on the lake, could hit as well, and sirens were going off.
Tom Nelson, how are county roads, how are critical infrastructure holding up at this point?
I just spoke with our highway commissioner, and there might be a few, but for the most part, we're up and running. So there were some roads, mainly within the city of Appleton. I think there was a point where 441 came down to a standstill. There were some problems in 41, but that was taken care of relatively quickly. But for today, things have been pretty cleared.
And so what will this cleanup process look like? Tom, you first, in terms of Outagamie County.
Outagamie County, we are in pretty good shape. I think for us, we're talking about maybe a week or two. I think that there's going to be some neighborhoods and houses. The houses that have been destroyed, that's going to take a long time. But clearing roads, getting power back on, gas leaks, taking care of that, we should be up and running pretty soon.
And Gordon, for you with Menasha, what might it look like with this cleanup in Winnebago County?
Well, I think it's probably going to be a little longer. We still have first responders, you know, that are going door to door, trying to check on properties, trying to check on people. We don't have power in a lot of places. Folks that are trying to get into their properties, that may have either gas leaks or power lines that are down, face risk and can't get back in. We're trying to sort of integrate our GIS support across the county, Menasha and Fox Crossing, to do some mapping of the grid maps for damage assessment and field response, so we can sort of coordinate and manage expectations of, you know, when we're going to be able to get, you know, where and when. We want to make sure that the most critical facilities to serve the public are together, because, again, our water utility for Menasha and Fox Crossing were impacted by the power outage. So those communities are currently getting their water through the city of Neenah, which is why we've asked folks to conserve on their water usage so that we have the capacity to maintain that. So it's going to take some time. It's unclear when we're going to get power restored to some areas. And there are places that are completely wiped out. There are places that are destabilized and dangerous. That'll take some time to sift through. And we're going to be working today on what the coordination and next steps can be, and try to manage the expectations with the public and the community on how to do that, and just ask for their patience.
Well, Gordon and Tom, really appreciate you joining us for this update. Thank you, and take care.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is Gordon Hintz, Winnebago County Executive, Tom Nelson, Outagamie County Executive, been talking about the tornado that swept through the area yesterday.
Coming up, the 21st Century Road to Housing Act is now federal law. What will it mean for local governments and builders to tackle the affordability crisis? The Wisconsin Builders Association responds.
Housing affects everybody, and we need everyone to work together to look at the programs and come to the consensus of how can we all support and move things forward.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kedar Cherkent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. With her unapologetically progressive campaign, Francesca Hong has defined this year's Democratic primary for governor in many ways. But her Democratic Socialist platform has some traditional Democrats worried about whether she could win in November.
As part of our ongoing series on candidates in the governor's race, WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk has this profile.
A recent Sunday afternoon in Madison presents the kind of glorious summer day that reminds Wisconsinites why they brave the long winters. And yet a few hundred people are spending it crammed inside a dark concert hall. They're here to see Francesca Hong, the chef, state representative, and Democratic socialist who's running for governor. In between musical acts, Hong addresses her supporters.
I truly mean it when I say what makes this campaign different is that we're building the movement to meet the moment.
That approach has won Hong a uniquely passionate following from people like Fallon Morrissey, who's selling merch at the back of the room.
I haven't had the opportunity to support a politician that actually represents my views and my beliefs.
Democratic socialists are surging nationally thanks to concerns over the cost of living. And the prospect of Hong winning Wisconsin's Democratic primary for governor seems entirely possible. Her calls to tax the rich and impose a moratorium on data centers make voters like Peggy McCrum say that they trust her.
If it's us versus the billionaires, then they're going to be paying out politicians to do their bidding. So it's like whoever is not taking that and having a grassroots campaign is my vote.
In an interview with WPR, Hong says she didn't necessarily expect to be a front runner.
But I don't think it's just our campaign that has, carried that forward. It's the political climate.
That climate is just right for a Democratic primary, where polls have shown Hong leading the field. The general election is another question. There are some Democrats who worry that Hong's brand of politics won't play well in a general election. Republicans have seized on this. A group affiliated with the Republican Governors Association is spending millions of dollars on ads that sound like attacks.
That's Francesca Hong, too liberal for Wisconsin.
But may actually intend to rally liberal support behind her. The theory is that they want her to win in August because they think she'll lose to Republican Tom Tiffany in November. Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, who briefly got out of the race for governor, emphasized the GOP ad when he got back in.
The Republicans have made their choice, spending millions of dollars.
Crowley has presented himself as the alternative to Hong. Governor Tony Evers endorsed him, and Crowley says campaign donations are pouring in. Other Democrats have said Hong's record on issues like police makes her vulnerable. She's called for defunding the police. And last week, in video captured by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, she picked up a megaphone at the site of a deadly police shooting in Madison.
State-sanctioned violence was an execution.
Tiffany immediately clipped the moment for social media to paint Hong as radical and divisive. Speaking to WPR, Hong said her take on law enforcement is more nuanced than people give her credit for.
I am serious about public safety, and if we are not tough on causes, we cannot be tough on crime.
Hong says that what helps her connect to a broader audience is her background. She's a single mother, a renter, someone who still picked up bartending shifts even when she served at the Capitol.
Regardless of where they may be in supporting me, a lot of people tell me that our campaign gives them hope.
It's a personal story, but Hong sees her candidacy as part of something bigger than herself. To some Democrats, this movement is worrisome and could cost them the governor's office. To Hong's supporters, it's a reason for hope. Anya Van Wagtendonk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR will continue our series on the governor's race Thursday with a profile of Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley. This is WPR News.
The 21st Century Road to Housing Act is now a federal law. The law aims to boost housing affordability and construction across the country, though a variety of incentive programs and regulation changes as well.
In Wisconsin, a Forward Analytics study found the state needs to build at least 84,000 new homes by 2030 to keep up with demand.
Since 2018, the median price for a single-family home has more than doubled to $360,000.
What will this new federal law mean for home builders and home buyers here in the state? Andy Sellner is a partner for Allaire Homes Green Bay and president of the Wisconsin Builders Association. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
In both the hats, as you wear, with Allaire Homes and the Builders Association, big picture, what's your initial reaction to this road to housing bill becoming law?
I think it's a great step forward. It's a big animal, that's for sure. We're early on in getting across the finish line with it. So, yeah, there's a lot to uncover and a lot of unknowns yet, as any large bill, when it comes to the table, you know, we got to unpack a lot of things.
Like you mentioned, it covers a lot of ground, 380 pages long. You pointed us toward one. I was thinking mostly about, you know, new construction. You pointed us toward the Whole Home Repairs Act that's part of this new law. What does that do?
This really creates a HUD program to support state, local whole home repair programs and provides grants, forgivable loan programs to homeowners, landlords for home repairs and modifications. What I like about this, in doing just the quick high-level research for Wisconsin and how it affects us locally, you know, right now the average age of a home in Wisconsin, I believe it was somewhere around 45 years old, and over half of the housing stock in the state was built before 1980. So when we put that into numbers and how this program can help locally, state level, I mean, it's a huge opportunity for those home buyers that are buying their first homes that, you know, are getting those fixer-uppers, but the way inflation is going, the way pricing looks, you know, they struggle with home repairs. You know, how do we update the furnace? How do you update some electrical systems? Where if we can create these programs to help those new home buyers, it just opens up the door of opportunities for those maybe waiting on the fence, looking to buy their first home, knowing that, hey, we still have to save up for home repairs, or really get discouraged when they're looking at homes. You know, this program can help alleviate some of that.
So that's low-hanging fruit in some ways, right? It can be a tall order to build lots of houses. If we have the houses and they just need a little extra love, that could be a quicker fix to some of our housing shortage needs. Do I have that right?
That is true, yeah. And I think that's what we really need to look at. Like you said, what are the whole low-hanging fruits that we can tackle issues right off the bat? You know, there's other provisions kind of tying to that Home Repairs Act. There's the Title IV, it's Accessing the American Dream. There's a number of sections in there that kind of speak to that as well, because, okay, they might be able to get those programs up and running. But there's also, there's one creating incentives for small dollar loan originators. So some of these sections in this title requires evaluation of the impact to current points and fee thresholds for small dollar loan lending. So when you think about it, if you're going in for a loan, and sometimes it's difficult to get those home repair loans. So a lot of these provisions really kind of look at that as well of like, how can we incentivize lending institutions to be able to create small dollar loan mortgages for some of these homeowners? You know, so that's another low hanging fruit that we can just tackle right away.
Now, you mentioned this is rolling out. It'll take a while to see the impact. When it comes to those things we've talked about so far, the whole Home Repairs Act, those smaller home repair loan incentives, if people listening right now are thinking, hey, I want to do that, can they do it now? Or do a lot of I's and T's have to get dealt with before it actually is on the ground here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, great question, Rob. Like any other bill, they do take time to really just hammer out those details of it. When it comes to funding and grants, like any other bill, they take time to get through the funding. Where are those funds coming from? Do they have to go through the budget process yet in the next cycle? So they might be years away. They may be closer than we think too. It just all depends on how and what's tied to those provisions are. I mean, we even on the state level passed Act 120 for neighborhood improvement districts. So there's some stuff working on our state level that's already passed in the state. You know, it helps give municipalities new financing tools to create neighborhood improvement districts, you know, levy special assessments to fund infrastructures. You know, there's meaningful options for our local municipalities right here and now that just got passed this spring.
Another focus in the new law has to do with streamlining some federal permitting and environmental reviews, especially when federal money is involved in building. I know things get complicated. There's different levels of regulation. How much of an impact does a federal tweak to that kind of streamlining of permitting and review have when it comes to creating housing?
Well, I think every little bit helps, you know, whether it's on the federal level or state level. It's making that awareness and what areas are federal programs tied to any local programs that might be slowing us down as well. So it's great to see that, you know, they're looking at reforming some of those areas and helping out and kind of pushing some of those regulations back to the states and local municipalities to help make those decisions easier and streamline that process.
On a related note, the Road to Housing Act tries to incentivize local governments to promote new housing using grant programs and saying, hey, you make it easier to build, we'll make it easier for you to get grants. I'm summing up pretty tersely there. Is that something you see being helpful?
Very helpful. Very helpful, Rob. You know, and we even look at that locally, too. And I'd like to see that the federal program is helping that out because it's going to help us on a state level. You know, locally, we've recently passed Acts 237 and 239, you know, expanding WIDA program and updating those provisions that we already passed locally. So it's exciting to see that on the federal side, that's going to help us locally and get those provisions through to be able to help our local municipalities. Because when it comes down to it, we got to work side by side with our local governments to help these programs get used.
We're talking about the Road to Housing Act becoming law and how it could affect Wisconsin. Andy Sellner is with us, Wisconsin Builders Association president and home building partner. Andy, when I've talked to people about housing in the last bunch of years, really, I've heard things like, okay, you want to build luxury housing that you could sell for a lot of money? You can do that. Low-income housing that has big federal subsidies, you can do that. But that starter home, either for a family to buy, maybe a young family, or even a rental home, that's where it's hard. The economics are hard to get those built. What do you see here in Wisconsin when it comes to that first, not necessarily subsidized housing, but workforce affordable housing for that young family?
Yeah, it definitely is a big issue we're looking at and trying to tackle as well locally. It all starts with our, like I said, our local municipalities and how can we help them and incentivize them in a way to work alongside our builders to be able to get those programs started. You know, a number of acts we've passed recently in spring, you know, our Truth in Planning Act, our Voluntary PAYGO Workforce Housing TID. So there's a number of programs that we are locally working on to help create those districts and help create those local municipalities and really create less friction is probably a good way to put it. When it comes to regulations and it comes to getting development started and it comes to getting affordable housing built in Wisconsin.
I hear people raise concerns about zoning, things like you have to have certain lot sizes, you can't have X number of buildings within a certain number of acreage, things like that. Do you see that as an obstacle, a roadblock to this kind of housing?
Yes, that is definitely an obstacle we're looking at. And that's where we're working together with some of the local municipalities and to get that message across of, hey, what can we do to help alleviate some of that regulatory pressure and to be able to open the doors to some affordable housing?
You mentioned inflation earlier. I want to talk specifically about construction materials. We heard supply chain problems after COVID raised the cost of lumber, windows, other products. Then there have been concerns about tariffs were relevant to the products used to build houses. What do you see when it comes to the cost of the stuff we build houses out of?
It is high, and COVID was the defining factor for a lot of our pricing. Like anything else, as it goes up, it hardly comes down because of inflationary rates. So we're definitely seeing an increase on it, and it's one of those kind of the plateau that's a new norm of where we're looking at for our pricing of housing nowadays.
And how about the labor side of things? I've heard concerns, again, when I've talked to builders and housing experts that we don't always have the workforce we need. What are you seeing along those lines?
Yeah, that's always a constant struggle, Rob. It's something we're definitely keeping our eyes on. When we look at even our generations, you know, the baby boomer generation, they're going to be retiring in the next few years. That's going to be a huge gap to fill when it comes to our workforce and building new homes and getting trade labor in. So it's a number of different areas we're looking at, you know, different technologies. How is AI going to be helping us in the future? What technological advances can we look in the construction industry to help alleviate that labor pressure?
I want to zoom into your neck of the woods now, Andy. You're based in Green Bay. I believe your company also works in Door County. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges, demands, or maybe opportunities where you're working?
I think the biggest thing that comes to mind is really land availability. To be able to get those developments up in the system, to be able to have lots to build houses. It's definitely always a challenge of where can you build the homes? Because if you don't build the homes, you don't create the inventory. So I think that's our number one challenge we're seeing in our area. Our labor is as well, you know, the number of trades that are out there, our skilled labor force. Like I said before, it's dwindling with as our older generation goes into retirement now, and how do we replace and fill that gap? Those are probably our two biggest areas of concern right now we're seeing in Northeast Wisconsin.
I want to check out some wish list items for you. We were talking about the Road to Housing Act and the key elements. Is there something that wasn't there or that needs to be sorted out? What would be on your wish list at that federal level?
Oh, I think this is a great start. There's a lot to this bill. I like that it looks at programs and brings them, I'm going to say, up to date. You know, raising cap funds in certain areas, reducing friction in some, you know, our environmental regulatories, whether it's, you know, passing permits and getting things moving through faster and quicker. It's a great start, and it's a great thing to see that it's a bipartisan support, because really housing isn't a political thing. It's really, everybody needs to be involved.
Speaking of political things, you may have noticed we have a race for governor going on right now. The state legislature, come January, will have a new governor, a lot of new people in the state legislature. If they came to you and said, hey, Andy, as a builder, what are your hopes for state law or regulation changes to help meet our housing needs? What would you tell them come January?
Well, I would tell them, let's work together. Because like I said, housing affects everybody, and we need everyone to work together to look at the programs and come to the consensus of how can we all support and move things forward, whether it's reducing regulation, creating more affordability for our Wisconsin families.
And I guess I should end on one really basic question. We keep hearing that, you know, we have a shortage of housing, a looming, increasing shortage of housing in Wisconsin. Do you see that? I mean, do you agree that we have a need that so far we're not quite meeting yet?
I totally agree. When I look at the numbers of where we were building, the number of units pre-recession levels, 2000, 2007, 2008, right in there, and I look at the number of permits pulled, the number of housing units we're building today, it's a vast gap in where we are. So we definitely need the houses, and not so much that the demand is there, but we need to produce the houses to incentivize companies and corporations to come to Wisconsin, to know that, hey, we have a strong housing, we got a great workforce, let's bring in and move our companies to Wisconsin, because it's going to help the economy as a whole.
Andy, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Andy Sullner is a partner for Allaire Homes Green Bay and president of the Wisconsin Builders Association. We've been talking about the 21st Century Road to Housing Act, now law in America, and how it'll affect housing construction here in the state.
Coming up, the American Cornhole League World Championships are underway in South Carolina. Hear from a Janesville native pro rank player on his love of the toss.
Anybody can play, anybody can truly win. And seeing the different levels at which people compete, it's what just drives me to keep getting better and continue.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The American Cornhole League World Championships take place this week in South Carolina, and Wisconsin is well represented with some top competitors hailing from the state.
Like Steve Schrader from Marinette County is the reigning ACL Pro Senior Singles Champion and the current number 2 ranked player in his division.
And Colin Powers of Janesville is part of the number 3 ranked ACL Pro Doubles team and a top 100 singles player.
I spoke with Colin last week as he prepared for the World Championships. The competition is airing this week on ESPN. How did you make the jump from playing cornhole casually to getting into competitive and professional tournaments?
It's kind of funny how that all started. It started just like many others, where you play in the backyards. You go to maybe a couple bar leagues or rec leagues around your town or neighborhood just to get out and have some fun with friends and family and catch up with people. And as I started doing that, it was just among the roles of socializing with people that they're like, hey, there's also these other places that have leagues if you'd like to expand your horizons and branch out. There's one in Madison, there's one in Janesville. And then as I got more familiar with those, the people, a couple of my friends and I, we got into it and we just would travel around with them. And the big one being that we found up in Madison, or rather Sun Prairie, that's run by Stacey Washa, is the American Cornhole Associated League. Meaning you're playing for points, you're playing for titles, you're basically getting your hands and feet wet into what the American Cornhole League is. So then as we learned that, we're like, wow, this is actually pretty fun. We have the free time. We play in their leagues. And then they eventually told us, hey, by the way, every year at the end of July, early August, they run a World's Cornhole Tournament. And that's where like the culmination of the season ends. Nations and where they also host a tournament that is called the Pro Qualifier. So expanding and going through that is kind of what led me then into qualifying. I didn't actually win that specific tournament. I won a different one, which then allowed me to garner the title of a professional cornhole player.
I love how you were building and building and building upon each of these different experiences. As you look back and reflect, what makes you passionate about cornhole? What kept you going through this process?
Honestly, what kind of kept me going and intrigued me to take it to this level was my friends and family, plus my background of being an athlete. I attended college, and in there I played collegiate baseball as a pitcher. So when I came back home after the baseball career ended, I was looking for something just to put my competitive edge into and get out and be with friends and family. So by traveling around with them and getting my fix of the competitive side, it's been great. It's garnered everything I've wanted. Seeing that the American Cornhole has ranges of ages from 9 to senior eligibility, it's anybody can play, anybody can truly win. And seeing the different levels at which people compete, it's what just drives me to keep getting better and continue.
What comes up here is friends and family really serve as a support system to you in the sport. How do you balance your professional cornhole career on the road with trying to have a regular life at home and a job back home?
It definitely is a juggling act, to say the least. Thankfully, the American Cornhole League and the tournaments that I play are mostly weekend driven. Now, it does create some long weekends, especially with working a standard Monday through Friday job back home here. So with that, I work and then I basically take off on a Thursday night or Friday morning, and I come back Sunday nights, pretty late sometimes depending on the flight. So that creates a long Monday in some worlds, because you got to keep both jobs happy and work through it. So it's definitely a juggling act that I couldn't do without friends and family helping to either watch my dog or sometimes drop me off at an airport even.
What about the mental focus here? How do you handle the nerves of competing on the biggest stages on networks like ESPN, and you're throwing and tossing with other people watching? How do you handle that mental focus?
The mental focus is definitely a key to this game, one that I am still learning to a degree and trying to master and get better at. Because with it, each year now that I've progressed, I have seen the pressure rise a little bit. The focus has to come along with the pressure of the lights getting brighter, playing on ESPN. But thankfully, with my background of playing college baseball or sports in general my entire life, I've gotten used to playing with a little bit of a sense of pressure and urgency in these events. Now, adding in the cameras of ESPN, that's somewhere I haven't been before. So that took a little bit more of an adjustment. But when the lights get bright, I just love to compete and put my best foot forward. Thankfully, it doesn't get to me a ton. But I'd be lying if I'd say there wasn't a little bit of nerve sometimes.
What does your preparation look like for the World Championships?
My preparation has basically been continuing to play my local leagues here on Mondays and Wednesdays. I go out and I play those that we run local blind draw. So it's a little bit of a tournament feel while getting in practice reps, as well as once or twice here, setting up some boards at the house just to throw for a couple hours, just to fine tune some details, mechanical stuff, and really make sure I'm honed in and locked in for what's at bay here heading up for the next week, since it's going to be a grueling long week of tournaments from co-ed to singles to doubles to just about anything out there.
Wow, throwing for a couple hours. This is also, you have to be ready in a physical sense as well.
Yeah, you definitely do, because you have to be ready physically to throw for the amount of time the game may take. But also what people don't understand is, maybe standing around, but you're inside your building or the facility we're at playing for 12, 13-hour days. Sometimes we show up at 8, 9 a.m. We may not leave till 10 p.m. or later. So that's just the constant being on your feet, getting ready, throwing just to stay loose, and making sure you're at the top of your game when your number's called to go to either a broadcast court or any court to compete. Because at this level, the moment you let your mental game slip or you're not ready, people take advantage of you and you go down in a hurry. You may even lose a game.
Do you have any expectations or goals for the World Championships?
I do have expectations of myself in hopes to definitely come out a doubles world champ. My partner and I, Richard Nyberg, we are a first-time pairing. He is actually from California. I am from Wisconsin here myself. So we actually never see each other at these tournaments. And this is our first year together. And we kind of stunned some people. And especially when you look at what the broadcasters' expectations of were of the top 10 teams even. We weren't broadcasted to be in there. So us finishing third in the world in doubles really put a target on our back and opened some eyes for some people. So heading into the tournament now where we establish ourselves, we definitely have the goal to, at worst, make the final four. We want to be there on the final day to compete for a world title that we've definitely busted our butts to give ourselves a chance at.
Colin, all the best to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you guys for having me.
That is Colin Powers, a professional American Cornhole League player from Janesville. He was with us to share how he's preparing for the ACL World Championships this week in South Carolina. Now, for a look at the popularity of cornhole in Wisconsin, we turn to Stacy Washaw, state director for the American Cornhole League and a founder of Mad City Cornhole in Madison. Stacy, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kate.
How widespread are cornhole leagues around the state?
All over, honestly. There, you can usually find a league within, 20 to 30 minutes, depending on your location. And then there's the more competitive leagues that follow ACL guidelines. And then there are a lot of backyard bar leagues, which most people are familiar with.
But before you started Mad City Cornhole, you used to have to go quite some miles to find a place to play.
Yes. Before I started Mad City Cornhole, I actually was only a backyard player. As soon as we put the league together, I was introduced to a whole new family of individuals who, yes, they were driving about 45 minutes or longer just to go and play bags on a weeknight even. It was crazy. That's really what prompted us to put the league together in the first place.
What do you think it is about cornhole that brings people together and motivates them to join leagues and to maybe travel on weeknights to go practice and compete together?
I would say one of the American Cornhole League, the ACL motto is anyone can play, anyone can win. I think that is one thing that really builds cornhole up is we have players that range from age five-year-olds who will play full length and beat, players that have been playing for years, all the way through 80s, and people with special needs, all different shapes and sizes, male, female. It really, you don't have an advantage just because of being in shape or, any other type of, I don't know how to explain that, but yeah, pretty much anyone can play and anyone can win.
How do you improve your skill?
Practice, and practice some more. There's also, once I entered the competitive cornhole world, learned about the difference in bags. So previously, when you're playing backyard, you just pick up a bag and it's filled with corn and you throw it. Well, the competitive bags have a lot more put into them. They're different materials. There's a fast side, there's a slow side, they have different speeds, different material responds to different weather conditions. Whether it's humid, then your bag's going to be slower. If it's dry and hot, your bag's going to, go lightning speed on the boards. And so that's something that I had no idea existed once I entered the world. So people love getting excited about their collection of bags that they have as well.
So there's like a grippy side and a smooth side. And then you decide what might work for that toss?
Yep, exactly. If you have, if the board has, you know, bags on it and you want to do a push, so you want to push a bag, one of your bags that's already located on the board and you want to slide it in, you're going to flip that bag over and use your fast side and for a push. Otherwise, yeah, there's a lot of different technique that, and there's a roll bag. There's all kinds of stuff. Pretty crazy.
I know that you're also heading to the American Cornhole League World Championships in South Carolina. What are you expecting from that event and from the Wisconsin competitors who are participating?
Yeah, it's a very exciting event. I am very privileged to be allowed to work alongside some of the best directors in the country for this event. This will be my second year working Worlds. I've attended for 3 years now, I believe, maybe four, but it is an amazing event. It's, you know, all week long, and there are different tournaments each day. There's, you know, all different kinds of doubles and singles, and there's some USA forces, and I mean, you name it, it's there. So everyone, you know, from all over the country and further, Canada as well, come together and to compete for their titles. And we have some amazing, you know, pros in the state of Wisconsin that also attend. And so we go there and, you know, cheer them on. And then you have, you know, some of your amateur players who are attending, who have never attended before. And that's always exciting to see. And then you have some that are also attending to try and become pro. So it's a really great event.
And Stacey, you are a pro at making new cornhole players feel welcome. What would you say to encourage someone to come and try out cornhole if they've never really played before?
Mm-hmm. I always, when I have new participants, I take extra time to encourage them and tell them not to be intimidated. You know, it can be very intimidating when you walk into a room and you see these players wearing jerseys and they're throwing their bags and every single bag is going in the hole. They all started somewhere, and you don't have to choose to participate and be ultra competitive. There are a lot of people who just want to show up and have a good time and interact and meet people. And so I just tell them, you know, give it a shot and talk to people, open yourself up, be vulnerable, because, you know, and we offer two different divisions on our weekly play, which I think is very helpful. And most tournaments have different divisions, so you can kind of be a little bit more in your comfort level. But then those players know, and they're excited when new people show up, and they want to encourage you. And I think that is what I rely on the most, and checking in throughout the night. You know, how is everything going? Are you having a good time? A lot of times I'll take them and introduce them to someone else right away. Hey, why don't you warm up on this board next to Jessica? You know, she'll kind of, you know, give you the DL on how the night's going to, you know, look and answer any questions that you might have.
Stacey, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
Stacey Washa is state director for the American Cornhole League and a founder of Mad City Cornhole in Madison. She was with us to share about the popularity of cornhole in the state. And earlier we heard from professional ACL player Colin Powers of Janesville, who's competing this week in the World Championships in South Carolina.
We're all watching as Menasha, Appleton, and surrounding communities recover from yesterday's tornado.
And if you were affected by the tornado and the storms and you have a story to share, please let us know about it.
Send us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or leave a message. That number is 888-642-0232, and we can share your story here on the air or at wpr.org. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.